Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is May 1st, and I have to say that a lot of you folks that live in more temperate climates don't understand what a big deal May is for those of us who live in places like Wisconsin. We've waited a very, very long time for spring, and it's a beautiful day here. May is, I won't say that May is the most beautiful month up here, but it ranks right up because inevitably there's one just absolutely gorgeous day. And for people in Wisconsin, it's marks the end of the long hibernation, and everybody comes out, and it is fabulous. And we all have the memories of that one day that we would skip school. Nobody goes anywhere. Of course, there is no school now. It won't be quite the same in the quarantine, but it is May 1st, and so we have a lot to talk about today, including the grim news, the COVID-19 death toll in the United States is over 63,000. And this is the way the president talked about it.
I don't think anybody's done a better job with testing, with ventilators, with all of the things that we've done. And our death totals, our numbers per million people are really very, very strong. We're very proud of the job we've done.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about, including the Joe Biden appearance, denying the allegations against him. I want to talk about what happened in Michigan and also what Congress needs to do about liability reform. But let's start with this. And our guest today is our good friend Adam White, resident scholar at AEI. Thanks for joining us, Adam. I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Charlie.
It's May 1st. Feel like you need to have a parade, don't you? I mean, aren't you in the mood for a big military parade?
Well, Charlie, I always think of May 1st as sort of Wisconsin Groundhog Day. There's only six more weeks of winter left up there.
That's the way it feels. No kidding. Okay, so the president says our death totals, our numbers per million people are really very, very strong. How many times do we have to remind ourselves empathy is really not his strong point? So are you feeling very, very strong about this?
No, I'm not. We should all be grateful that the country has managed to bend the curve in some places more than others. I mean, we should be proud of that. The initial estimates, they were horrific, and a lot of pain and suffering by Americans, both those who suffer from the disease and those who have lost their jobs, their livelihoods, are responsible for bending the curve very, very well. We ought to both be proud of that, but also sorry or sad about all the pain that it's inflicted.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, yes, this is an accomplishment in large part because of what governors around the country did and the sacrifices that Americans took with these stay-at-home orders. But it is hard to get your head around the magnitude of 63,000 Americans dying, and that's the official number. The real number is probably higher than that. And I think it's beginning to dawn on folks that the models maybe understating where we're going, that we are already at 63,000 on May 1st. That latest model, the one that the White House is using, suggests that it would be around, 73,000 by August. But we're gonna blow past all of that. So it is not inconceivable. And I know Jonathan Lass wrote about this yesterday, that we could hit 100,000 deaths. And it's I guess, I think there are reasons for a lot of people to be proud, but the president's rah-rah I just think it's going to be more and more dissonant. Peter Baker has a great analysis. He said, empathy has never been considered one of Mr. Trump's political assets. He views public displays of sadness as weakness and has made a point of stressing resolve, even at the risk of overlooking the deep pain afflicting so much of the country. His favorite words in his televised appearances of recent weeks are powerful and strong. He talks of incredible days ahead without dwelling on the miserable days of now. He plans fireworks while Americans plan funerals.
Right. And there's this just astonishing dissonance between the campaign theme of Keep America Great and the fact that in America we are locked down because of a coronavirus outbreak that, of course, the president himself didn't cause, but right. He certainly helped to exacerbate through his administration's wasted 2 months from January into March. It'll be interesting to see what kind of mood the American people are in, especially if there's a rebound in the fall or if this drags into the summer.
Okay, now speaking of the politics of reopening, everybody's seen the images out of Michigan, the Michigan Capitol, where you had armed protesters who looked like they stormed the Capitol. I mean, I'm looking at the pictures. I'm not sure whether they made it into the chambers or not, but you had tweets from elected representatives looking up into the galleries, and there are men in camo with long guns, with look like semi-automatic weapons. And I guess the question is this winning hearts and minds? What is the deal with bringing, and I don't know whether they're loaded or not, bringing weapons into a Capitol to protest in this particular way? Any thoughts about that, Adam?
This performative mob violence, which of course is not new, and we've seen it in the past on both the right and the left, there's no place for it in decent American society. And the fact that there aren't just total condemnations, especially from our side, from the conservative side, I think is pathetic. I think that there needs to be more and more focus on this. I mean, it's not hard to imagine if it had been Antifa that had stormed the Capitol, if it had been the Black Panthers who had stormed the Capitol with all these guns, this would be going wall to wall on Fox News for 3 weeks. But there's going to be no real accountability for this within the conservative family, precisely because we're just sort of accustomed to there being people who show up with guns from time to time, whether it was the protests on the cattle lands a couple of years ago, the Bundy family, or whether it's sort of the harder edge of the Tea Party movement that really, you know, I think should have been distanced by the real sort of genuine Tea Party. It's just pathetic that there aren't more condemnations of this from people who actually believe in law and order and civic responsibility.
You know, believe it or not, I'm a big Second Amendment advocate and have been a longtime Second Amendment advocate. But and I assume that somehow this is part of we're exercising our Second Amendment rights. We have the right to be able to do this, et cetera. I would argue that this is highly counterproductive. Tim Alberta, who actually lives in Michigan, has written extensively about Michigan politics, tweeted out, I know lots of Trumpers in Michigan. I know lots of gun owners in Michigan. I know lots of people upset with the government in Michigan. No one would bring a gun to the state. No, I'm sorry, not one of them, he knows, would bring a gun to the statehouse. GOP leaders would be wise to renounce this fringe lest they lose every suburban mom from Oakland to Kent. Okay, so that looks at it from the political point of view. But I guess what is the purpose of bringing the guns other than to intimidate, other than to frighten? I mean, is that a side effect of this, or is that the overt intention?
I think it's really just strictly performative. This is like the conservative version of gangster rap from the 1990s, you know, riding around, showing off your guns. It's really pathetic. But even more pathetic, I think, is the fact that you don't have conservative leaders, both in and out of government, just thoroughly denouncing this for the nonsense that it is.
Yeah, and not to mention the disrespect to law enforcement. I mean, we flipped from I back the badge to why are you guys stopping me? And there's a picture that's gone viral of some bearded guy screaming into the face of two officers who are wearing masks. None of the protesters are wearing masks. Okay, so Adam, you mentioned something sort of just in passing. Try to imagine if this was the Black Panthers that showed up at a state capitol or the U.S. Capitol, all carrying firearms, what the reaction would be.
I think it speaks for itself. We saw this on Election Day 2008 when a couple of Black Panther members showed up. I think it was it a Philadelphia polling place or somewhere?
Yeah, it was in Pennsylvania somewhere.
Right, trying to intimidate voters. And that became a media sensation, and rightly, I mean, I don't know if it should have been a media sensation, but it was rightly condemned. And people who sort of apologized for, tried to excuse that sort of thing, really, embarrassed themselves. And now we're seeing the same thing, sort of this embarrassing silence in the face of this ridiculous and dangerous protest.
Well, it is dangerous because I think one of the things we've learned is that things on the fringe that are tolerated tend to grow, and after a while, they're no longer considered fringe. And in a divided country that is angry, you don't know how far that edge is going to get. So,
Who shows up at the next protest to counter protest? We saw this in Charlottesville. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the big story of the day as we start the month of May with still in the midst of this coronavirus, which continues to take thousands of American lives, and the economy still reeling. The big story of the day is Joe Biden, the former vice president, who has been accused of sexual assault, not just gropey, feely, creepy behavior, but actually sexually assaulting a woman. And there's been a lot of pressure on Joe Biden to address this directly. Now, his campaign had denied the charges by a woman named Tara Reid, but Biden himself had not. And throughout the week, the pressure has mounted day by day for him to come out and address this. And he did. He issued a statement and then went on Morning Joe, where Mika Brzezinski subjected him to pretty intense grilling. Let's listen a bit.
And please, to our viewers, please excuse the graphic nature of this, but I want to make sure that there is no question as to what we're talking about. She says in 1993, Mr. Vice President, that you pinned her against the wall and reached under her clothing and penetrated her with your fingers. Would you please go on the record with the American people? Did you sexually assault Tara Reid?
No, it is not true. I'm saying unequivocally, it never, never happened. And it didn't. It never happened.
So your thoughts, Adam, did he stop the bleeding? Does Joe Biden survive this?
I think Joe Biden survives this. I don't think his denial of the accusations is going to be anything close to the end of the story. But I think it is the beginning of the part of the story where the Biden campaign and Joe Biden himself really grapple with the gravity of this, that they need to deal with this accusation now and settle it now before we get into the fall. Your colleague and my friend Jonathan Last pointed out, I can't remember on which of the podcasts, but he pointed out that we should expect to see Joe Biden's accuser at the presidential debates, just as President Trump brought Bill Clinton's accusers to his debates with Hillary Clinton. This story isn't going to go away because President Trump and his defenders won't let it go away. And so everything that Joe Biden can do right now on the side of transparency and disclosure and seriousness is crucial. And to the extent to which his defenders try to marginalize this or rationalize this and say, well, Trump is a bad person, he did these things, I think they're fooling themselves. They need to grapple with the substance of this right now.
Yeah, and I think probably right now should have been a week ago. Look, I mean, we need to focus a little bit on the Olympics of hypocrisy that we're in right now. I mean, if you're a Trump supporter and you have a guy, you're backing a guy who's bragged about grabbing women's pussies and who's been accused of assault by more than two dozen women, and now they're going to pretend to be really outraged about Joe Biden. So that's number one. Then number two, you have all the progressives who've assured us that all women had to be believed and who embraced every allegation against Brett Kavanaugh, including ones that I think you look back on as being absolutely not credible. So I think it was appropriate when Mika Brzezinski confronted Biden with his own quotes. Remember, he said, for a woman to come forward in the glaring lights of focus, you've got to start off with the presumption that at least the essence of what she's talking about is real. So you have a lot of people on the left, in the Me Too movement, who really now are like, okay, wait, can you tell us more about that due process thing?
Right. This the debate that we're going to have right now, I mean, in the coming weeks, about Joe Biden and Tara Reid, it's all sort of the culmination of the fights over not just President Trump and what he has said and what he's accused of, but also the entire fight surrounding Brett Kavanaugh and the accusers against him, the way that Kavanaugh was treated and his accusers were treated in contrast with Biden. I mean, it's just astonishing as we go into this presidential election how the last 3 years of these major, major fights, the Trump election and the Kavanaugh election, or sorry, appointment, are now all going to come together once more time. I mean, I want to be very clear here. I don't think that the Dr. Blasey Ford's accusations ever had any real substance that could be taken seriously against now Justice Kavanaugh. I think that people were right to be skeptical of her, just as I think people are right to look at Tara Reid's accusations with a measure of skepticism until she can really bring real evidence to the table. I think that's just a basic function of due process. But what I want to say that, and here I am talking about the Kavanaugh situation myself, and I do definitely look at the way Biden's defenders are now treating him and sort of raising my eyebrow given how they treated Brett Kavanaugh. That said, one of the dangers, as I just said, is that this is all going to become just competing fights of Me Too or You Too-ism, right? Of other side-ism, right? This is going to become all about the accusations against Trump. It's going to become all about the accusers against Kavanaugh. When again, I think Joe Biden really just needs to grapple with this situation. I saw somebody on Twitter yesterday. I'm blanking on his name. He's a former Justice Department official in the Obama administration.
Oh,
he's
now Matthew Miller.
Yeah, he had a tweet that I thought just exemplified the absolute wrong way to go about this. He said, Joe Biden is not under any obligation to release any documents related to this accusation so long as President Trump hasn't released his tax files. And as long as President Trump is the president, that's the norm and that's what we're going to live with. And that was wrong on so many levels. One, trying to equate a debate over tax files over a debate over sexual assault. I just think that's a ridiculous comparison. Two, the fact that President Trump did something wrong in terms of not, going along with the normal disclosure of tax files, that doesn't make it the new norm. And three, just because President Trump does something doesn't mean that that's now the standard by which Joe Biden should conduct himself. And I think that Biden's surrogates and advocates do themselves a real disservice when they say that Joe Biden is just going to live up to Donald Trump's standard and no more.
I should mention that Matt Miller is kind of a friend of mine, and when I first saw that tweet, I kind of nodded because you know that you're going to get that back and forth. But I loved your response. You didn't use your best line here. You said it's going to be a long year of partisans gerrymandering arguments around the obviously correct answer just because of Trump. I've never seen that phrase. I love that, gerrymandering arguments around the obviously correct answer, because you're right. But we are sort of drawn into that. Well, what about this? How do you compare this? Do you drag Joe Biden through all of this when you have 25 credible accusations against Donald Trump? Are we really going to have a debate about Joe Biden's transparency when you have zero transparency from Donald Trump? But I think that, that's what's unfortunate about these debates, is that there's something about this era that brings out literally the worst in everybody, including their use of debates. So I actually think that Joe Biden is going to survive this. And I actually tweeted out six reasons this morning. It's actually in my newsletter, which I should remind listeners, you can subscribe to the Bulwark newsletters. They are free and there's three every single day. So here's what I'm thinking. First, there are really too many legitimate problems with Reid's account. She keeps changing the story. It was a very interesting op-ed piece by a former prosecutor in USA Today that talks about the changing stories, the inconsistencies in the stories. There are real credibility issues here. That's number one. Number two, Joe Biden finally did what he had to do. His denial was unequivocal. And even though he had some shaky moments in that interview on MSNBC, he did survive the grilling. Number three, and I think this is important, the accusation of sexual assault just doesn't seem consistent with Biden's conduct, which is creepy but not rapey. He's a guy who does use his hands, in a certain way of a certain generation, but to see him doing something aggressive doesn't fit the pattern that I think some of the other, real villains of Me Too have established. And number four, as far as I can tell, the Democrats seem to continue to rally around him, including most women's groups. So that's a political reality. Number five, our news cycle, if we've learned anything, it moves awfully quickly and we do forget things. And number six, we're sort of now looping back. Whatever you say about Joe Biden, Donald Trump's record is so much worse. And you, before we started the podcast, you mentioned that the Mika Brzezinski sort of ran through all of the women who've accused Donald Trump of assault. And we're talking, by my count, 25 different accusations. So there is kind of this standoff. Do the Trumpists really want to have a discussion about this when there's so much there? And I guess that's why I think that, you know, we're going to talk about, there'll be a lot of chatter about, you know, the Delaware papers, et cetera. But I have a hard time imagining that this will change the overall trajectory of the race. But of course, you know, check back with me in September, October. What do you think?
You know, I think I agree with most of that. I'd say about the news cycle, you're right. We're all constantly chasing the latest thing, but we're usually chasing the latest thing that Donald Trump has sort of thrown out there. And so Donald Trump really is in charge of the news cycle. And I think that he or his surrogates will find a way to return to this issue again and again. You know, President Trump, so his usual go-to move is the border wall, right? When things aren't going well, he throws out a tweet, or now this most recently an executive order on immigration. He just throws it out there like a shiny object to distract people. And I think that as we get into the campaign of into the summer campaign and into the fall, if Joe Biden hasn't really resolved this issue in a real way, I think we'll see President Trump and his surrogates throwing this out there whenever they want to change the subject. And also, we just have to remember the weird circumstances of this presidential election. Joe Biden is campaigning for president from his living room right now, and it's not clear how much real campaigning he's going to be able to do. He's going to be at a real disadvantage in general in terms of messaging and visibility if he's constantly having to react to a news cycle that's defined by President Trump on this particular issue whenever President Trump wants to throw it out there. President Trump also, because of sort of, again, to get back to the point that had been raised about President Trump's lack of disclosure versus Biden's lack of disclosure, President Trump's going to be able to say once again in the summer, every time somebody asks him about his taxes, which they will, since it's a presidential cycle, he'll say, listen, I'm not going to disclose any documents about my taxes until the Biden campaign comes totally clean on the accusations from Tara Reid.
Yeah.
And he's going to bring this up over and over again whenever he likes, at least if he feels like he's facing an uphill climb in the polls.
Oh, I think that there's...
So that I am worried about.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And of course, you know, the media was sort of browbeaten into covering these allegations, which... I think the double standard between the way they handled Kavanaugh and the way they handled Biden was pretty obvious. But now I think that there ought to be a significant pushback against the media to say, OK, we understand that there's a lot of women who've accused Donald Trump. And, you know, one of the advantages, weirdly enough, that Trump has is there are just so many that the media has kind of given up trying to cover it. But I think there will be that pushback as well. Before I want to get into the question of liability, because this is actually one of the most disturbing stories of the week, and I want to get to that. But just one thing I mentioned in my newsletter this morning that sort of struck us yesterday. You know, we've been talking about, you know, the future of the non-Trumpian Republican Party, and I think generally in the context of the complete extinction of the non-Trumpian Republican Party, that it is utterly irrelevant. And if you look at Congress, you really get the sense. I mean, you know, name a single member of Congress who's still in the Republican Party who has consistently pushed back against Donald Trump. And, you know, we get Mitt Romney, Justin Amash, who's actually left the party. But you get the sense that it is completely Trumpified. And we've seen actually, you know, a couple of things over the last couple of, you know, weeks that have reminded us, no, the future of the non-Trumpian Republican Party is right in front of us. And it may be the governors. I mean, the governors around the country have these Republican governors have just stunningly good ratings. I mean, you have people who Governor Hogan from Maryland is at 80%. Governor Baker from Massachusetts is at 80%. DeWine in Ohio is 83%. And so I do think this is an interesting thing to watch, that we've been so Washington-centric that we've missed the fact that there actually are Republicans who are carving out a very, very different vision of the Republican Party, and with tremendous success right now.
Yeah, in many ways, it's reminiscent of the 1990s. You know that from being in Wisconsin,
yeah.
With Tommy Thompson, right, laying the groundwork for welfare program and education reform that became a role model for the Bush administration. In that same era, you had governors. Mayor Giuliani dealing with crime. You had these Republican leaders from across the country really sort of leading on particular issues. And that
Mitch
was a great,
yeah.
Mitch,
yeah.
Right. And that was a great, great era for sort of the rebirth of Republican and conservative politics. And so I agree. I'm hopeful right now, with governors like, DeWine and Hogan and Baker, that what we're seeing is some real, sort of redevelopment of the Republican Party and its ideas in a good way, and also just it's showing that Republicans can lead in like a genuine leadership and accountability role that President Trump has sort of caricatured but avoided throughout his 3 years so far.
Okay, you have to help me on this liability issue. You had a piece in the Bulwark earlier this week that Congress needs to solve the COVID-19 liability problem. And this is going to be a huge issue because there seems to be a move, at least in among the Republicans in the Senate, to basically simply make businesses immune to lawsuits in order to induce them to open up. And so you have this kind of nightmarish scenario where essentially you're forcing businesses we're forcing employees to go back to the business, to go back to work. And then stripping them of any ability to hold that business liable if, in fact, they are infecting the workers. So how do you strike this balance? I mean, you can understand why a business will say, look, if I'm going to reopen up, I got to make sure that I'm not going to be destroyed now by lawsuits. On the other hand, you do have people who, in fact, may be injured by these decisions. How do you strike that balance?
Well, this all started with a point that the Bulwark has made really well over the last several weeks, that, you know, governors and President Trump can declare the economy, you know, open for business, but until businesses actually open and employees go back to those businesses and customers walk through the doors, the economy isn't open. And one of the big issues that bubbled up last week was this question about liability, right? You have groups, and now there's reports out by the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and others really raising concerns about businesses being exposed to just broad class action lawsuits or individual lawsuits by plaintiffs' lawyers if somebody, either an employee or a customer, thinks or claims he or she contracted the coronavirus on the job or in the store. And as a former practicing lawyer, I'm definitely sympathetic to those worries, right? That people are going to catch coronavirus while they're on the job or shopping because of just the way community spread works. And having reopened the economy is going to facilitate that. And people are going to want to hold people responsible for this. And then, of course, you're always going to have the plaintiff's lawyers who see an opportunity to bring lawsuits and force settlements and so on, sort of extract settlements. So the question is, what do you do with this? President Trump then comes out last week and announces, you know, we need immunity. And Larry Kudlow said, we need immunity for the businesses. And what that does is that they'd say it's an immunity shield. Well, it's kind of like when you're at the baseball game and somebody opens up, it's raining and somebody opens up the umbrella in the row in front of you and it just all pours into your lap. Mm-hmm. It's a shield for some people, but what it does is it really just shifts liability onto others, onto the workers, onto the customers, or onto the insurers. It all has to go somewhere. Who's going to bear the costs of catching the virus? Again, costs that are going to be exacerbated, you know, unavoidably by businesses reopening. So in the piece that I wrote for you guys, my point was just that Congress or state legislatures need to get involved with this. They need to figure out how to sort of reduce the uncertainty here by adjusting the legal standards, by prescribing what it is that businesses are going to be liable for, or sort of creating safe harbors that if businesses do these certain things, they are no longer liable for people who catch coronavirus at the shop. I focused on Congress because President Trump and now Senate Leader McConnell have raised these issues. It also could be done at the state level. The Utah legislature just recently passed a bill saying that you can't have COVID-19 lawsuits over just ordinary negligence, just sort of failing to do the right thing. You can only sue if a business was really reckless or knowing in allowing the COVID-19 virus to spread. Now, is that the right balance to strike? I don't know. It seems sensible. I'm not quite sure. But the fact is, it certainly reduces the uncertainty for businesses, and but also for employees and customers.
So if I understand your argument, you're basically saying that if you're going to pass some sort of immunity, you need to be as specific as possible.
Yeah,
right.
That's
right. That basically say we will allow you to be immune from lawsuits if you do A, B, and C. Like what? I mean, how specific are you suggesting the legislation be?
I'm saying if Congress wants to delve into this, they ought to think about it in terms of specific activities, the kind of things that the CDC and others have been prescribing as good practices. So if you clean all the surfaces in your facility every X hours, if you take the temperature of customers who come through the door, employees on the job, if you ask employees on a such and such basis about sort of the health conditions in their family or at home, those sorts of things, I think they have to be as precise as possible. You'll never have perfect precision, but as precise as possible, precisely so that the businesses know what it is that they're supposed to do. Now, there are other questions. The Chamber of Commerce put out their report, and my friend Richard Morrison at the Competitive Enterprise Institute was tweeting about this yesterday. Really, you know, profoundly difficult questions that the government needs to solve, like, can you restrict, you know, the employees who come back to work? Can you exclude older employees who are more vulnerable to the virus? Mm. Or is that unlawful age discrimination? Can you ask people and record information about people's health status? Or does that violate their health privacy rights? And Richard, in his line of tweets, goes through the thread of all these really difficult questions that just need answers. And even if it's not clear what the best answer is, what you do need is some answer just for the sake of clarity. What I am, you know, I am worried about Congress just passing blanket immunity because it will give certainty to business owners, but it'll also remind people who are going to work and shoppers that it's, you know, buyer beware, beware catching coronavirus when you go shop. And I'm also worried about the people who are going to be required to go back to work. Governor Reynolds in Iowa, who I really respect. She said something in the last few days that I think was kind of worrisome. She said if employees refuse to go back to their jobs, right, they can be fired and they won't be eligible for unemployment benefits. Well, is that really fair for employees who have spent the last 2 months sort of, you know, confronting these real health risks, suddenly being told, okay, go back to the job? And that's a tough enough challenge as it is. It gets even worse if you're saying go back to the job, and oh, by the way, if you catch coronavirus on the factory floor, it's your fault.
Yeah, that was that Dickensian moment where we're going to tell you have to go back, otherwise you lose your unemployment insurance, but we're protecting your boss against immunity. Okay, so I am not a lawyer, but I do know how lawyers think. So let me ask you, and by the way, I think your idea is great, but let me play devil's advocate with you. You know, you say that legislators can at least specify the types of protective measures that are required, testing employees and customers, at least taking their temperatures, asking other symptoms, trying to keep the sick away, distributing masks and gloves, cleaning all surfaces a particular number of times a day, and so on. Okay, so let's say we write that into the law. Haven't you then also then created very specific causes of action if a business fails to live up to any of that? So it's a Wednesday, they don't have enough masks, or the person who is responsible for taking people's temperatures does not show up for a couple of hours and somebody gets sick. You have specifically in legislation that their immunity, you know, is required if they check every single box. But flip side, if I'm a lawyer, I find one of those boxes not being checked, I now have a very specific grounds to sue that employer, don't I?
Yeah, two responses. The first is what this standard does is it really would require employers to make sure that they stick to those standards, right? The person with the who's taking temperatures disappears for a couple hours. Well, make sure you have a ready backup there at all times, right? So it is a real burden on the employers.
It is.
Make sure. But second, the way you'd structure the legislation, you just say that those activities create a safe harbor, you know, the absence of which the regular rules of negligence apply. So it wouldn't be what lawyers call strict liability. Okay. It would be what we call a negligence standard, which is a court and a jury has to decide, were you reasonable or not? And so this is a safe harbor, and absent that safe harbor, you're just sort of exposed to the ordinary rules of the road, which right now are very uncertain, given, again, sort of the situation we're all dealing with. But it isn't just, as I said, strict liability, where if you fail to clean the floor, you're stuck.
That's a good answer. That was what I was looking for. So I know you neither you or I are economists, but here's we're sitting here at a very, very interesting moment at the end of April, where we just got new jobs numbers in. I think it was 3.8 million more Americans had filed for unemployment, which brings the total up to 30 million. We are going to be looking at unemployment rates that you and I have not seen in our lifetime. And yet, April was one of the best months. The stock market had one of the best months it has ever had in April. Now, every once in a while, somebody will say, well, the stock market is not the same as the economy. But I mean, yeah, no kidding right now. This is part of the cognitive dissonance here. That we have Americans dying, you know, massive numbers of Americans out of work, and yet the stock market is frankly not that bad. So what is the state of the economy, and how do we deal with those sort of contradictions? Or how should we think about the best contradictions?
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
No kidding.
I'd say the stock market is a long run measure, right? The stock market is sort of looking for the future of the economy, right? And so it's not mutually inconsistent to say things are bad, really bad, right now at this moment, but things could be better, much better, just a year from now or just 6 months from now. I mean, that's how I think of this dislocation, right? That when 30 million people, just astonishing number, and I'm sure your friends, as some of my friends, have felt this pain directly. It's not that they were told by the economy, we don't need you ever again, right? It was we don't need you, we can't afford you at this moment. And so I think it's incumbent upon the country, either at the federal level or the state level, to continue to find ways to bring economic support to those people, ideally through direct payments to the people who need this most, knowing that, as the stock market, you know, suggests to us, better days will come. And when better days come, we will be able to sort of pay back the debt we're undertaking right now to support people. That's how I resolve this.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly one of the narratives, and I think you're right. But there is another narrative as well, which is that a lot of what has been done, particularly with the Fed, has been to protect money, just been to protect capital, so that a lot of the pain has been shifted to lower income workers and people who are struggling in that way. But big corporations have been taken care of. People with money have been taken care of. The Fed has you know, really underwritten capital. And the lead story right now in the Washington Post is $1 billion in funds meant for small businesses instead went to public firms. Publicly traded companies receiving money from this Paycheck Protection Program include 43 companies with more than 500 workers, which is the maximum typically allowed by the program. So, you know, several other recipients were prosperous enough to pay executives $2 million or more. Look, I don't want to sound like Michael Moore or Bernie Sanders, but I do think that you are seeing a different approach to capital than to labor. Wow, I do sound like them. I'm sorry.
But it's right that, I mean, almost by definition, the most vulnerable in our society were the ones who most immediately felt the horrific impacts of this. Look how easy it is for me to sort of say, oh, we need to keep things locked down for another couple of months. I teach and I write, and I've been able to do that for the last 2 months from the comfort of my home office. It saved me over 2 hours of commuting every day.
Yeah.
But because of this, it's so easy for people in my position, and also in these communities that you're talking about, Wall Street and elsewhere, to just sort of breeze through this, and the fact that they seem to be getting a lot of benefit out of this, it really should offend us. I'd say one of the things, as somebody who teaches on the structure of government and so on, I mean, so much of this is expected, right? Congress wrote a very, very broad law, the relief bills, the CARES Act. They didn't write, you know, a whole lot of standards into who would qualify for these funds. They wrote some, and they said, well, we'll have these accountability mechanisms with this oversight and special inspector general and so on. But of course, then, when this fire hose of money went out, it wasn't the most precise way to distribute things to the people who need it most. And now you have people in Congress sort of circling back and saying, this is terrible. How dare these people take this money? Well, yeah, of course, and that's a bad thing. But Congress, if they would take their own job more seriously in actually writing standards on who would get the money or not, then we'd have much less of this problem.
Oh, no kidding. And of course, we found out today that the Senate says that they don't have the capability of testing members of the Senate, which is like, wait, I thought we had this wonderful testing thing. We've had conversations about this. Congress, even though its poll numbers are somewhat up, certainly has not covered itself with glory, I don't think, in the way that it has handled this, but this was completely predictable. So Adam White, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast. A great way to begin the month of May, which I'm really, really hoping is going to be better than the month of April, and I hope is better than the month of March as well. But see, hope springs eternal.
I cherish your optimism, Charlie.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.